And good evening, ladies and gentlemen. That beautiful music must mean that this is Wednesday. And being Wednesday, this is The No Show. Welcome to your No Show, the Blog Talk Radio program on the Renford Broadcast Radio Network that addresses New Thought Metaphysics, which simply means a new way of thinking as we move beyond the physical and discuss the metaphysical aspects of spiritual intervention that incorporate the wisdom of yesterday, the technology of today, and allow us to bridge the gap and move into that space and place right in between the dots. My name is Robert J.V. McMillan, and it is my pleasure to serve as your host and to invite spirit-filled people to share with us how it is that they are showing up in the world, how they are making a difference in their neighborhood mosque, temples, churches, synagogues, and even the neighborhood 7-Eleven, and then taking that to their states, to their countries, and ultimately to the world. We are so pleased this evening that you decided to spend a few of your LPEs, your life's precious energy, with us. And my guest this evening is a dear, dear friend, many, many, many long, wonder-filled years, even this lifetime, as well as others. Dr. Maisha Havoc, an innovative educator, a behavior change communication specialist, a speech writer, a media consultant, and a New Thought minister. She holds advanced degrees in communications as a PhD, transpersonal psychology as a PhD, behavioral science with an MA, and counseling with an MSc. She, in other words, is just a heavy, heavy, heavy lady, and wonderfully filled with this wonder dress, one dress spirit that is within her. I have known Mai for many, many, many years, this particular lifetime, and I know that who it is that she is how it is that she always shows up in the world. I'll have a lot more to say about her in a moment, but I want to also share with you that currently Maisha Havoc conducts workshops in school districts and spiritual communities on the brain, heart, and learning, the power of your subconscious mind, emotional intelligence and emotional healing, strategic intuition, ecumenical cooperation, and spiritual activism. Now, that sounds heavy, doesn't it? Well, it is heavy, and it is also very, very, very light. And it is, even more importantly, very, very, very wonderful. This evening, we are going to visit with Dr. Maisha Havoc about Selma and America, today and yesterday, nonviolence as the key to freedom, not just the key to moving forward, to going where we need to go in life and doing the things we need to do, but the key to life. Good evening, Maisha Havoc. How are you? Maisha, are you
yes, I'm here.
In color.
Good evening, everyone. I think I got stunned by all the many, many. You've known me for many, many, many. I was wondering how many many you were going to get in there.
Oh, I didn't want to do that. Now, see, I don't want to tell the people how many, because looking
right,
at
we'll leave it at that.
Your beautiful portrait, we don't want to go there, Mai. We definitely don't want to go there. But I'm so happy that you are back once again. You are not a stranger to the No Show. You've been here before, and we are excited that you will come back often just to share with us, to kind of let us know what's going on and how things are. We have a very phenomenal subject that we're wanting to talk about this evening, and one in which you pretty much have kind of written the book on this subject in terms of nonviolence as a key to freedom. And for the people who received the email, they saw the information and they saw that beautiful piece there with Nelson Mandela and Martin Luther King and Gandhi and who was the fourth person?
Cesar Chavez, I believe.
The Dalai Lama? No?
The Dalai Lama was on it. I'm trying to remember the graphic I sent you.
Yeah, the one that sent me had the Dalai Lama, Dr. King, and
Nelson Mandela.
Nelson Mandela and Gandhi. That's the one that you sent to me. And that's very appropriate for our conversation because all of these people were into nonviolence. And, of course, so many people went to visit with Gandhi, including Malcolm X, who I believe went there and visited with him and then came back. But tell us about your work. Tell us how you got into it, where you're going with all of this good stuff, and what's going on with you.
Okay, I'll start off by saying that Kepler Institute of Applied Metaphysics and our Center for Inner Peace, those two organizations that I co-founded, are participating in a season for nonviolence, which comes around every year since 1998 when it began. And the season is from January the 30th to April the 4th. Those two dates are the memorial dates for our remembrance of the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi on January the 30th, 1948, and the assassination of Dr. King on April 4th, 1968. So every year, the Association of Global New Thought has this season for nonviolence, and we, during this season, talk about nonviolence as the ultimate strategy for bringing peace in the world, looking at nonviolence as a way to wage peace. And I actually got into it really as a child. My sister and I were two children who were used in what we call our father's integration experiment. It was my very first time going to school. I was on my way to first grade. I had really been looking forward to it. I had had a chance to go to school with my sister every once in a while, and she was going to the all-colored school in Eastern Maryland at that time, and my big brother was going to Moton High School. And I was excited about getting my opportunity to go to school, and at that particular point, just before, I'd say within the months before school opened, there were 14 African-American children who were selected and volunteered by their parents to participate in the integration of an elementary school. There, on the eastern shore of Maryland, they decided to integrate the schools using elementary school children rather than high school children, as they did at Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. So at the age of five, I'm sitting in nonviolent direct action classes. I'm not sure they called them that at that particular point, but that's what it was. We were in these sessions where there was a lot of prayer, there were lots of songs being sung to bolster up our real sense of divine protection. And at the same time, we were going through little role-playing scenes where we would be told that the children that we would meet in the elementary school we were going to would most likely spit on us and call us names, and there might be lots of things happening like that. And so we were being trained to take insults and even physical pushing, hitting, spitting, kicking, to take all of that and not fight back. What I remember most is that sitting in Asbury United Methodist Church, actually it was Asbury Methodist Episcopal Church at the time, there in Easton, I was sitting next to my mother, and as they were talking about all the things that would happen, all I can remember is pulling on my mother's skirt and saying, "But why, Mommy, why? Why? Why would they spit on me? Why would they hit me? Why?" But they had us act out what we would do. So they would have someone who would come and rush at us in a threatening kind of way, and we were to be able to stand and look them in the eye, and not push or shove, but stand and look them in the eye, or step back, and simply let all the energy come from them. When I think about it now, I think about something that my grandmother used to say. She used to say, "Let there be one fool at a time, and make sure that fool's not you."
Right. that is not you.
Right, right. Let there be one fool at a time, and make sure that fool's not you. And in a sense, that was really the essence of the training that we were getting, that there would be individuals who might be acting a fool out of their own anger, out of their bigotry, out of their meanness. Mm-hmm. And in those cases, we were to let them go on and act their thing out and not become emotionally engaged by it, and definitely not become physically engaged if they bum-rushed us, so to speak. So it began, my whole experience with nonviolence began at 5 in those nonviolent direct action classes.
Wow. Wow. At 5 years of age. I, as you know, Maisha, was raised here in Little Rock, Arkansas, where I am right now. And I remember going to, initially going to the Baptist church and school, and then going to Catholic school. And I remember responding quite differently, but my training was very different from yours. And I learned rather quickly to appreciate the public libraries, because it was in that public library that I learned how to punch and jab, bob and weep, and then cross. And so I learned in first grade that was an important thing for me to know and to move. And of course, my granny, who was Baptist, but sent me to the Catholic school, shared with me rather quickly, "Baby, I am sending you there to get your education. I am not sending you there for training in boxing." So let's be real clear on that. But I wonder how your brothers and your sisters, because you had an older brother, Walter Hazard Jr., who was a professional professional basketball player, and was with the L.A. Lakers, I believe, right there in California for a wonderful period of time. How was the same training? Did the same training apply to them, and did they respond? Did your brothers respond in the same way?
Well, the integration project, as I usually call it, or experiment, really involved elementary school children, and my brother was in his first year of high school at the time. So he was upset because he didn't think it was right for our parents to put my sister and me in that kind of situation. And he had a good reason to be upset about some things that were going on, because we had threatening phone calls. I remember one night, maybe 2 or 3 weeks before school opened, or before school was supposed to open, it ended up opening later than it was supposed to because of the uproar about integration. But anyway, about three weeks or so before school opened, I remember my father coming into the bedroom maybe 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and I remember him saying, "Get up, get up, get up, get up, come on, get up now." And he was pulling our bathrobes off the hook on the door, and he was saying, "Come on, get up," and he's pulling us out of the bed. And I remember rubbing my eyes and saying, "But I'm sleepy, Daddy, leave me alone, Daddy," and he just picked me up. And he ran down the steps with me. My sister was in front of us. And we went out of the house and across the street as the fire engines were coming because there had been a bomb threat. And so the fire department was coming to check through the house to see if they could find the bomb that the telephone call said had been planted in the house. So there were a lot of things that happened. Many of the specific things that happened before school opened, I don't remember. And that's because I was 5, so I didn't have access to all the information. Our parents weren't trying to scare us to death before going in. They were trying to prepare us to walk bravely, to be bold, and to be assured that we were protected, which is one of the things I really wanted to talk about tonight.
Please.
I think as I was watching the movie Selma, the one thing that occurred to me was that there wasn't a whole lot of attention on the spiritual preparation that the people had before the marches, before any of the demonstrations. And what I remember so clearly as a little girl were the prayer meetings that we had at the church, the evenings when folks sang and prayed, because they understood that we were going into potentially dangerous circumstances. They knew that the parents who had said yes to having their kids go into the school to integrate it, that they were putting their lives on the line, because there was a lot of anger about it. And as a matter of fact, there were 14 of us at the beginning when we were being trained to handle ourselves in the situation. And by the time school opened, there were only 7. The parents of
only
the other seven.
Wow. Only 7.
Only 7. And we were all, we were between 5 and 8.
Wow.
We were all in.
I just wonder, Maisha, if I would have been able and would even now be able to put my child through that, to know some of the biases and the bigotry and all of the ridiculousness that can be a part of ignorance and bigotry, if I would be willing to put my grandchildren now through that type of experience. And what must they have been, your parents, what must they have been feeling to allow you to go through that? They had to have the big picture in mind. They had to see where it is that we are today. And I wonder if you could address that possibility as well.
Well, my father was one of the leaders of the NAACP and of a group of ministers, black and white ministers, in Eastern Maryland, Eastern Shore of Maryland at the time. And so he was one of the architects of the whole experiment. What I remember very clearly is that there were times when he was speaking to the members of the churches to try to get more people engaged in participating in it. I remember him saying, if not us, who? If not now, when? Those words just, you know, kept ringing out in my mind, even as the years went by. But I can tell you that in the early part of the 80s, I'd say probably 1983, 84, must have been 84, I had just joined the faculty at Ohio University in southeastern Ohio, which is in the rolling foothills of the Appalachian Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a Quaker woman who found out that I was there. I was the only African-American on our particular faculty in telecommunications. And she heard that I was there, and so she came in and asked me if I would go up in the hills with her to speak to children in 2 elementary schools in 2 different small towns. And
mm-hmm.
I said, well, of course I'll go. She said, well, what will you talk about? We were going for Martin Luther King's birthday. And I said, well, I think I'll talk to them about the children of the civil rights movement, because very few people talk about the children who were involved. And because my sister and I were 2 of those children across the country, across the South, I'd like to talk to them about that, tell them part of my story. So I was preparing to go up in the hills with Helen to talk to the children, and it happened to be that we were going to a school. The first school that we went to was a school that was across from a field where 6 months before they'd had the largest Ku Klux Klan rally that had ever been held in Ohio. So here we are. It's 1984. It's January. It's King's birthday coming up, and we're going to this place where we know many of the residents are Klansmen and Klanswomen. Well,
wow.
The night before we went, I decided that I would call my parents, because we, through the years, had never really had long conversations about the things that happened. And so I called them, and I had both of my parents on the phone, and I was asking my father, okay, tell me now about some of the meetings that you had, about the kind of preparations that it took for you to, first of all, get the school district to say yes, to comply. So he's telling me about some of the legal things that they did. He's talking about the community organizing that had to take place he's talking about, you know, dealing with politicians and all of that. And finally, I said to him, okay, Daddy, if you had it to do over again, would you put your 5-year-old and your 7-year-old daughters in such a situation again?
Right.
And he was quiet for a moment, and he said, absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
He said, if not us, who?
Mm.
If not then, when?
Mm.
And I said, okay, Daddy, I hear you. I remember that message.
Yeah.
I said, okay, well, I thanked him for giving me all the information. I said, okay, you can hang up now. But Mother, stay on the phone. So at that moment, I said to my mother, I said, okay, Mom, if you had it to do over again, would you do it? And she was very quiet. And I said, Mother, are you still there? She said, yes, I'm here. I said, if you had it to do over again, would you do it? And she said, absolutely not. And I said, whoa, okay. I said, well, tell me why you wouldn't. She said,
right.
She said, I don't know exactly when it was that I stopped following you to school every day.
Mm.
And I said, you followed us to school every day? She said, yes, you went out the front door. I went out the back door. She said, and I ducked behind houses and trees.
Mm.
She said, I was there at recess time. I was there at lunchtime.
Mm.
And I was there after school. She said, you would come in the front door, and she said, I would be rushing into the back door so that I could open the front door for you to let you in. And I
wow.
said, are you serious? She said, I think it was February or late February or early March. She said, I know it was snowing.
Wow.
And she said, on that day, the principal, who was really a very good woman, she was a Quaker, and she was a marvel and a wonder, a really wonderful woman. My mother said that the principal walked out, found her behind the tree, and said, Mrs. Hazard, please come in and have a cup of tea. And when she went into the principal's office to have a cup of tea, the principal said, I'm watching the girls. I'm watching all of the children. I
mm.
promise you that we'll keep them safe. Please don't stand out in the cold. Please don't
wow.
get frostbitten. Coming. She said, I've
wow.
seen you every day. She said, but it's snowing. Please, go home. So when I got off the phone that evening from hearing my mother say, absolutely not, I called my big sister, who was my protector during those years. Really, up until I was a teenager, she was my protector. Anyway, I called her and I told her what I was getting ready to do. I was going up in the hills to speak to children in these rural communities. And I asked her, I said, did you know that Mom used to follow us to school every day and that she was out there every day at recess and at lunch? She said, yes. She said, don't you remember one day you were crying? Something happened and you were upset and you were crying and I told you not to worry, that Mommy's here, and I pointed to her, and up until that moment, I hadn't remembered that. But then suddenly I got this flash of an image of my mother peeping around a big oak tree. And that came back. So I began to ask my sister at that point the things that she remembered.
Mm-hmm.
And she started telling about things that happened. And I would say, really? I don't remember that. And, you know, on the 10th thing that I didn't remember, she said, how can you not remember this?
Sure.
How can you not remember?
Sure.
And so we kept on talking. There was one story that opened my memory banks. She said, don't you remember the day that the boys, that group of boys, pulled you into the stairwell and they were kicking you and beating you? And at first I said, no, I don't remember. She said, how could you not remember? And then suddenly I got this flash. And what had happened that day was, it was the first time that I had decided to leave my classroom by myself. I always waited for my sister to come to the door at recess time, at lunchtime, because my sister had asked the principal to make our recess time the same,
mm-hmm.
because she was afraid for me. Because all seven of us were spread out throughout the school. We only had one of us in each classroom. I guess if you had a group of little black kids between 5 and 8 in a single classroom, I guess a riot would start or something. I don't know. But anyway, we were placed separately in classes. Like, I was in room 1, and the nearest kid that I knew, Carol Anderson, who was in first grade too, was down the hall in room 7. We were barely within screaming distance of one another. But so I would wait for my sister to come and take me out of the classroom, walk with me, because, you know, I knew that if I went by myself, you know, the kids would kind of bump me, and I would always wait until they got their coats and hats out of the cloakroom, because if I went in with them, they would knock my head up against hooks. They would shove me a bit. But so this one day, my sister was late, later than usual, and I was feeling kind of bold, so I said, oh, I'll go find her. So I stepped out into the hall, and I was walking around the corner to go towards the part of the building that I knew her classroom was in, and these boys grabbed me, and they dragged me into the stairwell. And the reason that my sister found me was, as they dragged me into the stairwell, my shoe fell off. And so she saw my shoe outside the door in the hallway. And I could hear her calling me, but I was so petrified that I couldn't answer.
Mm.
So when she found the shoe, she opened the door and she came in and she started pulling boys off of me. And she kept saying, why didn't you answer? I was calling for you. I was looking for you. And I just couldn't. I was petrified. Anyway, that was the beginning of a lot of memories coming back. So that night, after I hung up from my sister, I literally cried all night. And about 5:30 in the morning, I called my parents' house. I was in Ohio. They were in Pennsylvania. And all I could get out when my mother answered the phone was, Ma, they were so mean. They were so mean. And she's going, Maisha. And I'm just saying it over and over again. She's saying, okay, calm down. Take a few deep breaths. Yes, they were mean. Yes, they were. And I'm saying, this woman is coming to pick me up in an hour. And my face is puffy. My eyes are red. I look like I've been out on a binge. I can't go talk to these kids. I'm a wreck. I've cried all night. So she talked with me for about 20 minutes, and she said, you need to go. Perhaps you need to go. So I went. Helen picked me up, and when she looked at me, I knew that she was wondering if she had been wise to invite me, because I did look like a wreck. And so I got in her car, and I said, okay, it's not as bad as it looked. I have not been out on a binge. I am not drunk. Here's what happened, and I explained to her what happened. And she said, are you going to be able to do this? I said, yes. So we drove up into the hills of southeastern Ohio, and we pulled up at the school. And as we were walking in, I'm looking around, and I'm realizing, oh, my goodness, oh, okay, I can do this. I'm not seeing any other African-American anywhere around at that point. So I go into the office, and I ask the secretary where the ladies' room is, and I go in there, and I knew she could hear me because she was close to the door of the restroom, and I'm in there talking to myself, splashing water on my face, and I'm imagining that she's and kind of laughing. I'm a little bit hysterical, a little bit off at that moment, but I'm breathing deeply, and I'm remembering, okay, but you know what? I survived. Okay, I'm fine. Okay, I needed to remember. Okay, I can tell my story. So I come out, and we go into this cafetorium, you know, one of those cafeterias they change into an auditorium for events. And I look around, and I see 6 or 7 little black faces in this sea of white. And, you know, it's even more like I'm having flashbacks, too. I forgot to tell you that. And I'm standing there, and I'm looking. I'm seeing these small brown faces in the middle of the sea of white children, and I'm still having flashes. But I'm breathing deeply, and I'm saying, okay, infinite intelligence in me knows perfectly how to speak from the heart in such a way that something happens today that makes a difference. Something happens that changes something in the hearts of these children of the Klan who are sitting here. And that's what I'm saying as they're going through the Pledge of Allegiance and singing the Star-Spangled Banner, those things that they did at the beginning of their assemblies. And they called me and introduced me. And I got up and I said to the children and the teachers, I was a child of the Civil Rights Movement, and I want to tell you about some of the children, some of our experiences in integrating classrooms and schools. And I said, now, I don't know if I can tell my story without crying, because I've cried all night because there's some things I didn't remember, and so I talked to my big sister last night. I'm giving them some of the information I just gave you. And I said, so bear with me. I'm going to share. So I started telling them the story, much of what I've just told to you, and a little bit more. I'm telling them about the first day of school when the minister at our church, at Asbury Church, whose granddaughter and grandson were going to integrate the school with us, came to pick us up. My father had decided that he could be of greatest help by holding vigil while we went. So Reverend Anderson drove. So we get in the car. My mother is with my sister and me. We get in the car, and we drive around to the school, but we can't get within a block and a half of the school because the streets are lined with all of these white parents who are carrying baseball bats and sticks and rocks and have lined the streets. So he had to park, and we had to walk the last block down the middle of the street, surrounded by the sea of angry white citizens of the town and the township. So we get to I'm telling them this story about how my mother is holding our hands. She's got a death grip on the two of us, and she's saying, look straight ahead, don't look around. Look straight ahead, don't look around. And I can remember, you know, walking and trying not to look around, but feeling the anger from the crowd and hearing the names that are being called. And we get to the front of the school, and we walk up the front steps, and there are two men there holding jars. One says acid, and the other is just a jar of this pink liquid. And the man with the jar of pink liquid, which I understood later was lye, said to my mother, if I were you, I wouldn't leave my pickaninnies here. You don't know what they're going to look like when you come back. But what I remember most about that moment is that my mother, who was not a big lady, big woman, stood up and looked him in the eye and said, excuse me. She said it with such truth force that he backed up, and so did the other man. And the way was made clear, and we walked in. I'm telling the children that story, which I want to come back to in just a moment, because that to me is indicative of what Mahatma Gandhi called satyagraha, soul force or truth force, which is the core of nonviolent direct action. If you don't get that part, you can't do it. You really can't do it. But let me go back to the children up in the hills, and then I'll be quiet, and you can actually ask me questions if you like. But so I'm talking to the kids, and I'm telling them this story. And as I'm talking, the tears are just rolling down my cheeks. And I get to the point where I tell them the story about the seven boys who pulled me into the stairwell. And I remember in that moment when they pulled me down the steps, there was one boy who really didn't want to do it. As a matter of fact, he was telling them, oh, leave her alone. Come on, leave her alone. Let's go. And he kept saying it, and the two bullies who were in the lead, you know, looked at him in, you know, threatening way. And there were four boys in the middle who really didn't want to do it. They were kind of caught up in the energy and the intrigue of it and their fear of the bully as well. And what I said to the children that day was there was one kid there who really, really, really didn't want to do it. He knew it was wrong. There were four others who really didn't want to do it either. They weren't, you know, really, they were kind of caught up in the energy of it, but they weren't into it. there were just two, and really one in particular who was the main leader, who was mean to everybody. And I said, if the boy who really didn't want to do it, who really understood that it was wrong, had really stood his ground, those four boys who were wavering in the middle would have followed him because they didn't want to get in trouble and they didn't really like doing what they were doing. I said, the majority of the people in the world are good people. Unfortunately, most good people who really want good things to happen in the world are cowards and cower before the bullies. But what I said to the children was, but one person can make a difference. One person standing on what is true and what is right can change the tide. And at that point, I talked to them about Rosa Parks and a few other people. But the point that I want to make here is that what happened that day, which I think is critical to our conversation here, is that as I looked around, as I was coming to the close of my talk, I sang a song that ended, and I'm looking around, and I see that the children are crying, the teachers are crying, all quietly. I end the song, the spiritual that I ended with, and there was absolute silence. And then thunderous applause. And at that point, the bell rang, and the teachers were trying to get the kids off to the next thing that they had to do. But there was one fifth grade class that wouldn't move. The teacher kept saying, come on, and they wouldn't move. There were about 16 kids in the class. And finally, one little girl ran over to me from that class, and she said, can I hug you? And I said, oh, yes, please. I really need a hug. And so she hugged me, and she said, thank you for coming and telling us your story. And then as she was walking away, she said, my cousin was hit by a bus last year and died. Now, it sounds like it has no connection to what I talked to them about, but I knew that what she wanted me to know was she understood what it was like to feel pain,
feel
hurt.
That's right.
Right? Absolutely. Right?
Absolutely.
So at that moment, after she ran off, the other 15 kids ran over to me and they said, can we hug you too? And so there I am in the circle of white fifth graders, probably half of them children of the Klan, hugging me. And thanking me for coming to their school. At that point, as they ran off, Helen, the Quaker woman who had invited me, came over to me, and she said, "That I've never seen anything like this. She said, that's the most amazing thing I've ever seen." And I'm laughing at this point. She said, why are you laughing? I said, you know, I think I just sent some children home to burn their parents' hoods.
Their KKK hoods.
Yes, the KKK hoods
are no more. That's
exactly.
Awesome. Thank you. I want to jump in here and say, ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Dr. Maisha Hazard. She is in California as we speak, but she is a woman of the world, as you can hear, and there's no telling where she might be and when. We are just so pleased that she decided to spend a few minutes with us. We have three people right now on the line waiting to ask questions and or make comments. And I want to hear from you all who are on the line what thoughts you have in terms of your his and her story. What is it that this hearing these words brought up for you? And I want to hear from you, so I'm not going to even tell you guys all about all of the things that it brought up for me. But I want for you to ponder the eternal verity of that particular question for just a moment while I share with you that we are the RBR network of phenomenal shows. We offer a plethora of various shows for you to enjoy, appreciate, that will tickle not only your heartstring, but it will move you to action, just as Dr. Maisha Hazard is prompting you to do right now. On Thursday, as an example, we have the Progressive News Weekly show at 5:30 p.m. Central Standard Time, as are all of our shows, hosted by Daryl Clark from New York and co-hosted by Cecil McDaniel, who is also the director of the Renford Broadcast Network and Renford Broadcast Radio. On Thursday, we have the Searchers Roadmap at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, hosted by Rhonda Harrison from Red Feathers Lakes, Colorado, way up there. The Searchers Roadmap was the first RBR show and therefore is the longest-running show. Rhonda is a healer and often hosts shamans from around the world at her home 9,000 feet up the mountains of Colorado. Rhonda is also the moderator for this particular show, for my show, and so we invite you to tune in with Rhonda at 1 p.m. on Fridays, Central Standard Time, for the Searchers Roadmap show. Immediately after this show at 8:30 p.m. Central Standard Time comes The Laws of Material Wealth with James Renford Powell, who is the owner of the network. And all of us are wanting to know how to extend ourselves financially and to bring in all of the good that Spirit has in store for us. And so that is what James talks about on his particular show at 8:30 p.m. Central Standard Time tonight on Wednesday. And so we invite you also on Saturday to catch the Soul Town Sound of Music show from Memphis, Tennessee, hosted by Reginald Jenkins. And then on Sunday, the Dream Vision 7 show at 3 p.m. Central Standard Time, hosted by Deborah Bouvet of Boston, Massachusetts, or one of her hosts. This is the second of the two weekly shows that come to RBR from the Dream Vision 7 network, with a broad cross-section of 150 hosts from around the world. This is a cooperative program that we have to expand our listener base and, even more importantly, to allow you to really find the niche that you are looking for in terms of growth and extended understanding and wisdom and direction. And, of course, I welcome you and thank you for tuning in week after week here to The No Show. And it is a pleasure for me to invite people like Dr. Maisha Hazard. Maisha is not only a dear, dear friend, she also introduced me to this field of metaphysics and walked hand in hand with me during a very traumatic period of my life when my children and my wife died in a fire. And so we know each other well. And when people will stand by you during your times of challenge and crises, as well as your good times, you know who it is that they are. So we are pleased to invite her to come back again and again. And we're not going to do it tonight because I really want for you to hear what we're talking about in terms of the opportunity of nonviolence and why it is that nonviolence is so important, especially right now in light of the Fergusons. And in light of the Washington, D.C.'s and the challenges that are going on all across our nation right now and some of the things that are happening. But I feel, as I heard Dr. King, I think it was, say a while back, that God has not turned this world over at that time to the Lester Maddoxes and the George Wallaces and the Orville E. Faubus of the world. Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, all of those folks changed their stripes, but they changed them through the faculty of nonviolence and, we got to be honest about this thing, some opportunities for violence as well. Somebody said, speak softly but carry a big stick. Doesn't mean that you have to necessarily use it, but you want to carry it. Okay, you guys have just been wonderfully patient, and I am so grateful. I know Brother Carl in Maryland has been waiting and chomping at the bit to come in and with Maisha and to make some statements, because, Carl, you could relate to many of the things that Mai was saying a few minutes ago, and I want for you to share with us what your thoughts are, because you're just about 3 or 4 days older than I am. So I want for you to come in and share with us some of your wisdom and your thoughts on what was said.
I'm happy to do it. I am sitting here still in a state of mostly silence. I'm enjoying the Dr. Hazard, the feeling that she presented to us out here in listening land with such power, and in addition to her PhDs and her ODs, and she's got a PD, a doctorate in power, because that's what I was receiving from her the whole time that she was talking. Let me jump back a second, Dr. Hazard, and say I was raised on the Dust Bowl and graduated to the hardwood, so I grew up with Walt Hazard. And I got just so much similar kind of pleasure at that time because I was a young man. Now that I am a mature man, I realize I get so much more power out of hearing the kind of story that you have shared with us, because in the end, I'm hoping that those of us who listen will realize more that the elements that you struck, all the elements of the powers that we have within each of us, are there inherent in us. And if we kind of go back and roll the tapes of our own lives, we may not be able to put the story together as tightly as you have and as wonderfully as you have, but we can put our own together, and that will help us identify those powers in ourselves, and we need them now more than ever, considering Selma, USA, Ferguson,
right.
USA, and
yeah.
Madison, USA, the University
right.
of Oklahoma, USA. We've got to look at those things universally, not what's so much as to what's going on there, except to use them as jump-off points to think. But we're already talking about action, and we need no action before strategy. We need to develop our strategy around what we are learning today.
Excellent.
Yes.
Excellent.
And that's one of the other things that your enlightening story has done for us. It helps us identify today and the struggles
Excellent.
That we still have ahead of us. And
Excellent.
I just want to thank you so much.
You're welcome. And what I'd like to say, what I thought I was going to really talk about today, before I got lost in my story, was the power.
Good?
Yes, the power that is within us, that's greater than anything that's in appearance in the world. It's the theme of the Blog Talk Radio show that I do every Saturday morning, which is on spiritual activism. And you know, I talk about the power within us. And as we look at nonviolent direct action, as we look at the individuals like Mahatma Gandhi, we look at the Fellowship for Reconciliation and the work they've done since 1915 using nonviolent strategies. When we look at Bayard Rustin, who really taught Dr. King nonviolent direct action. Nobody talks about Bayard Rustin that much. He was shoved into the background because he was flamingly gay and had been a member of the Communist Party at some point. So he had the strategies. But more than that, he had the understanding that it's the power within us that we stand in without the big stick. I can remember being in North Carolina during the summer when my father taught at Bennett College in Greensboro, North Carolina, in the summertime. And one summer early in the 60s, I was still in elementary school. I don't remember exactly when it was. He led a group to sit in at a Holiday Inn there in Greensboro. And before anybody went marching, they had a strategy, yes. They had a plan. But more than anything else, they were so grounded spiritually. The prayer meetings that I remember as a child before we went to school, before we integrated the school, as I remembered, as well as what I remembered that summer in Greensboro, the prayer meetings made hair stand up on the back of your neck. I mean, the songs that people sang, the fact that folks were grounding themselves in the sense that there is this power that is greater than anything that's in appearance, that there is something we can activate within ourselves, which is the power that I felt in my mother that day as she looked at these men holding jars of acid and threatening to disfigure her two little girls. There was such a sense of power in this little woman who looked at these men and said, excuse me, and moved them out of the way with the force of her presence.
Mm-hmm.
She was standing completely in the presence. She knew that the omnipresence is fully present where each one of us is. She understood that. She knew in that moment that one with God is a majority, that if God be for you, there can be none against you. In the prayer meetings and the services that folks had before the demonstrations, whether in Selma or Montgomery or Atlanta, Augusta, or Eastern Shores of Maryland where we were, no matter where it was, they were using the words of the spirituals as affirmations. You know, ain't going to let nobody turn us around. Or singing, as President Obama reflected on Saturday when he was in Selma,
right.
He talked about the hymn that they were singing, God will take care of you.
Uh-huh.
God will take care of us. The foundation of the movement was spiritual. The majority of the leaders really came out of the church. Dr. King, Dr. Abernathy, and the list goes on and on of the folks who were ministers. We look at Jim Lawson, Dr. Jim Lawson, who taught nonviolent direct action to John Lewis and James Farmer and the members of CORE, the members of SNCC, beginning in 1960. He had gone to India. He was a missionary for the Methodist Church in India for 3 years. And came back with an understanding of satyagraha, which Mahatma Gandhi talked about. So, you know, on one hand, you have the strategy that the human intellect can come up with. But if you're not grounded in a sense of a power that is beyond personality, then it's easy for folks to either make you cower or make you feel like you've got to go get a gun and a big stick to go after them. When
mm-hmm.
there's nothing like watching somebody who really gets this. I'll tell one story and I'll be quiet again. I know we just have a few more moments. I remember being in Philadelphia with my mother when she was in her late 70s. And I had shown up to spend a few days with my parents. And we went that day to get on a bus to go downtown, which my mother did almost every day. And as we got on the bus, my mother was in front of me. And as I stepped onto the bus, I knew, uh-oh, something's wrong. My mother had not taken her seat. She was standing, and she was standing in this stance of power. And I was like, uh-oh. I'd seen my mother do that a few times in my lifetime. That was the same stance she had when she looked at the man and said, excuse me, and he moved. There were 8 to 9 young African-American guys who were on the bus who were taunting an old Jewish man. They were knocking his hat off his head. They were calling him names. They were kind of pushing on him. And the bus was two-thirds full, but all the people were quiet in the back. My mother stood there, and she looked at them, and she said, stop. You will stop this now. Leave him alone and sit down. She said it with such force that these guys, you know, switchblades and whatever else it was they might have had, guns or whatever, who knew? They all sat down. They sat down because they were responding to the soul force that she had learned to bring to the fore through her spiritual practice. They sat down.
Right.
And she looked at them
That's
and she said, I know that you know better.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That is that power. That is the power. I want to bring in two other folks that have been patiently standing by on the line to share with us as
okay.
well, either ask questions or make statements. Mr. Mondale, you will be first, and then Ms. Pat, I will come to you immediately after that. Thank you so much, first, Mondale, for your patience. I understand that there was another person, like Job or somebody, that kind of had that thing, too. And he was rewarded well, so I know that yours is coming. Mondale, good evening. Are you with us?
I'm here. I actually, you know, I'm not sure I have the patience of Job's. Actually, I'm certain I don't. I am I'm an extremely, extremely impatient person, especially in times such as this, when black folk are being murdered around every corner in every city in this country. Well, I wouldn't say every city, but a lot of them. And I'm not really sure I'm 100% committed to nonviolence. I actually, I subscribe to a different idea, mainly because I know, the success of the nonviolence movement that we're talking about was grounded in the fact that had you not dealt with King and Abernathy and the rest of the Big Six, then you would have to deal with Malcolm X and those that subscribe to Black Power. So I know that there's a place, and even the nonviolent movement with King and those folk was protected by the idea of force. Everybody around King had a gun. King House was almost a fortress. And so, the nonviolence is important, but it's also important to say that it was so successful because there was an alternative that the white folk didn't want to deal with, and that alternative was Black Power, with the threat of the Vanguard Party being the Black Panther Party using force, so exacting the exact same thing on them. And I would say that it does as well if we remember that there has never been, there will never be, a revolution that turns over, take power, and claim freedom for those that are oppressed without some type of violence. I'm not suggesting that black folk go out and take up arms. I am suggesting that we acknowledge that violence is necessary. There's all types of violence.
Excellent. I'm going to leave the question there because I only have a minute and a half left, Maisha, for you to respond. And that's excellent. Thank you, Mondale, for sharing that. What are your thoughts on that?
I won't get through all of it right now, but I would say that no matter what matter, what means we use for freedom, we have to awaken within ourselves the inner sense of power. It's the nonviolent movement had force in it. It was soul force. Soul force.
Mm-hmm.
If you've never been in a situation where you've seen it work, it may be difficult to believe that you could go unarmed and face a crowd and have them stunned by it and have them back up.
Right.
I've seen it, and it can work.
Yep.
And, yes,
yep.
there are many means, and I
yep.
had respect for Malcolm X, for El Shabazz.
Absolutely. All of the stalwart soldiers.
Yes, absolutely. So we're not talking about punking out, folks. Let me just say this to you.
Right.
It takes the strong to be nonviolent. Okay, you got somebody else.
I have 30 seconds. So I want to tell the people where they can get a hold of you. Those who would like to follow you along, where can they see you, where can they email you, go up in your website, whatever, quickly.
Okay, I'll give an email. It's drmaisha@me.com, drmaisha@me.com.
That's right, excellent. Maisha, thank you so much. We every time we do this, we end up having this type of situation, so just pledge to me that you will come back, and we will do it again. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us this evening. This show would not have been what it was had it not been for your energy being here with us. We will see you next week again on The No Show. My name is Robert J.V. McMillan. I thank you so much for taking time and spending your WIIFMs with us. What's in it for me? You got a lot out of it this evening. Take care, folks. God bless. See you next week, next Wednesday, 7 p.m. on The No Show. God bless. We'll see you now.